It's Spoiler in Time, folks, the show where myself, Tom Merritt, and my co-host, Brian Brushwood, talk about the shows we've been watching. This week, we are going to talk about Deadwood, episode 7 of season 1, as we go back and watch something out of the library. We're also going to talk about the new Starz show, Counterpart, episode 2 of season 1. Brian, we are also going to talk about Electric Dreams, the episode Real Life.
Yeah, dude, you want to start with that one?
Let's do it. No movie draft to talk about this week, but that will be back soon. News to come. Meanwhile, Electric Dreams Real Life, starring Lucius Lyon and Suki Stackhouse. That's actually one of the weird things about Electric Dreams is there's so many stars that you're like, oh, wait, I spend half my time trying to remember where I saw the person. Of course, in this one, it's Terrence Howard and Anna Paquin. So they're so prominent that I wasn't worrying about where I saw them. But did you find that distracting at all, or did it suck you right into the plot?
I didn't. I was like, oh, famous people. And the nice thing about watching on a desktop with the Amazon X-ray feature is like, you know, in fact, I'm sure I paused it at some point and I was like, names I vaguely recognize. Yeah, well, let's watch the show. I liked it. I think this was a smart one to start it off with where I forget who said it. I think it was you, Bryce, that said, yep, that's Philip K. Dick there.
These are his stories.
That's yeah. I'm losing my identity. I don't know where I am.
Oh, no. Which one is real? Yeah.
Yeah.
If there was anything not Philip K. Dick about this presentation is that it left you with an answer.
Well, and that's what I wonder going forward. You guys have watched all the entire season, yeah. But I was left wondering, I wonder if they're all going to have nice, tidy endings like this.
It is a spectrum of endings. I will say that. You get a pretty wide swath of how much it wants to tell you and how much it does not.
Well, and I did enjoy the brief kind of meta-narrative thing when, you know, they get in your head about like, okay, well, the story started in this future place, so that must be where it starts. So you're like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting if it started in the VR fantasy and so on. But ultimately, it's a little tough to get caught all the way up when the storyteller is holding all the cards and withholding so much. But having said, you know, I still thought they were delightfully different worlds with interesting through lines in both of them. This was written by Ronald D. Moore, right?
The screenplay was. I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm a huge RDM fan for sure.
He's an executive producer on the series.
Okay.
And I do think he did. I think he wrote this adaptation for TV.
Yeah, I thought that the modern day story was really just weird enough and that I was really intrigued, you know, and I had the same questions that, of course, the main character had, like, why would you make that up? Why would you choose that reality? That's pretty messed up. And then the logical, you know, the no, this world's real. No, the other world is real. You know, shoot him. He's the clone. I don't know. I dug it. I thought it was fine for what it was. It was a real good episode of The Outer Limits, basically.
If there's one thing about Electric Dreams, I feel like they're trying to be Black Mirror / Outer Limits / Twilight Zone with Philip K. Dick material, and that just isn't always going to work. Philip K. Dick material is great as Philip K. Dick material. It translates to the screen quite well, as we have seen with Blade Runner and
Man in the High Castle and
Man in the High Castle.
Name it.
But Man in the High Castle. Yeah.
What's the Schwarzenegger one?
Total Recall.
So you can do it. But sometimes if you're trying to do it a certain way, material doesn't work so well. This one I think did. This one I think worked really well. And it's probably one of the best episodes of the series because of that.
Oh, I'm bummed to hear that because I found it quaint and I liked it, you know. And if that's one of the best ones, then I'm like, okay, we'll see.
I think that there's more that you'll like as the season goes on, but mm-hmm. I do think it's very front loaded, at least on the Amazon listing of episodes.
Got
and
it.
Yes, the irony is not lost on me that I forgot Total Recall. Remember Total Recall.
What about you, Tom?
What's that?
Wait, did you like it? I didn't get a real read on.
Oh yeah, no, I liked it. I liked it well enough. I pretty much saw where I was supposed to be looking all the time, which made me look somewhere else, which then made me go, "Oh, they're trying to make me think that, so that must be true." But I still was guessing, you know, a little bit towards the end. So I kept the ball in the air as far as like which one of these is real. I was a little disappointed that they pushed it in my face to say like, so Sookie's reality was the real one at the end. I would have almost preferred that they just let me hang and just be like, either one could be real. You decide.
Yeah. I don't know which way I would have preferred it. But I was happy enough with how it was.
I bet that there's a way to say, to hint at what the reality is, but the explanation in this epilogue moment is very direct.
Yeah.
And that's something
I would have preferred again. Something more like the last second of Inception, right? Uh-huh. Where it's like, there are enough context clues that you can know for a fact, but yeah. The last second ends seemingly ambiguously about whether it's reality or not.
Even if it's just like you just see a shot of her hooked up to all the stuff and it's not immediately apparent, but it could give you something to choose their solution.
Yeah, I didn't need her wife showing up and explaining, don't you see? She chose this because she is riddled with guilt.
The reality.
I've decided. Well, the way I wanted it to end was you pull out and it's Greg Grunberg passed out. And they're like, he's got two simulations running and they're battling for which one. You can't pull him out of it.
I'm okay with that.
Okay. Season 2. Yeah.
You turn in a script that says, by Ronald D. Moore, but it just scribbles out. It says Tom Merritt. And then it's all the script except the last part's handwritten on there.
Cast Greg Grunberg. Okay, so let's talk about Counterpart, which actually I think has a little bit of a Philip K. Dick, you know, aspect to it as well because of the dual nature of J.K. Simmons' character, Howard. And this episode, we find out that his wife, sure, we found out at the end of the last one that she's not dead, but we find out that she's actively working against him, sort of. I was actually having a conversation with you and Bryce over text message during the first like 10 minutes of this. And I feel like I was able to handle where it was going because they don't really tell you much, but it's really confusing to be like, okay, so she's working for an agency that tries to retrieve agents and she's coming to get him, but he thinks she's going to kill him. And then later, then she goes in for an evaluation and they don't seem to know that she was supposed to retrieve him. So was she, you know, working against them? Was she working against her husband? Like, it's almost too many questions on that side of things.
I am just, this is what I liked about that episode. I don't mind there being lots of questions as long as there's something for me to hold on to. And this episode had a very simple, very concrete premise. In order to get inside the mind of the assassin, they need to learn what they can from her counterpart. And so it's a miniature heist in that regard. And so, you know, everything we see from her is questions. What is the significance of this birdcage? Where is this place? What's with the tapping? What's with the bare feet and all that stuff? I do think it's fascinating that the first thing they do is mess up the face of this major villain character, like, you know, by having her get shot in the face. And then I immediately thought, oh, well, that'll be a useful way for you to know which one is which. And then, nope, they just killed the counterpart. So that doesn't seem to matter. And so now she's just got messed up face. I think J.K. Simmons is just extraordinary. Just chews up the scenery in every single set.
I'll be honest. I love J.K. Simmons so much that this show could be 10 times worse than it is. I'd probably still enjoy watching it just to watch him do his thing.
I don't normally notice these things, but they do a good job of giving you pegs to cling on to. One is, you know, the set piece for the interrogation where he slips a Mickey and she gets a loose tongue and starts talking about her childhood and so on. The other, like when Howard sees other Howard, and then he makes a moment of like, huh, you gotta be kidding me. We're both wearing the same shirt, but you're wearing a white t-shirt underneath. Why do you wear those white t-shirts? And you're like, oh, I just like them. That's a different thing between you and me.
They really stop the sweat, but I guess you don't care about sweat because you're cooler than me.
And, And I like that they're telling, you know, kind of this shrugging shoulders of like, yeah, no, we used to be the same person. Now we're pretty far apart. We're pretty different people. Although you're led to believe maybe not so different as you might think, given that we see Timid Howard punch out one of the members of his own team for assassinating that girl, which, by the way,
yeah,
that was a little bit frustrating to me, that the whole conceit was that they're trying to get Violin Girl to keep Assassin Girl from killing Violin Girl. They get there, and then instead of saving her, they kill her. And instead of killing her, Assassin Girl sadly watches her die.
Yes. Well, okay. Where I was going with my frustration with the opening scene with the wife was that what I really loved is that I didn't have to worry about that. Like, that stuff's still up in the air. And I'm like, okay, I could forget about that because of what you said regarding the fact that this episode is not about Howard. This episode is about the violinist. She is either a violinist or a violencist.
The title of this episode was Violins Never Solved Anything.
You can't hug a, I don't know. Anyway, so
with nuclear arms.
I love that it's their relationship with each other. I love that it's her pausing, like she knows she's just supposed to kill her, and she had the opportunity, and she couldn't pull it off right away. But yet, you still question whether she could kill her. I hate that we got to the point. And they either, you can interpret it either way. You can interpret it the way you said, which is like they shoot the violinist, or they thought they were killing the violent girl and they accidentally killed the double, even though it should be pretty obvious which one is which at this point.
Well, they even set that up. They're like, too much obstruction. I won't be able to get a clean verification of which person I shoot.
I know.
When the next person runs through there, they're going to die, whoever they are.
Yeah, it's just silly, though. Like, come on, you don't just shoot people. Although I will say they were trying. The point was to kill the violent girl, the violinist. And so they don't care if the violinist stays around or not. They only needed the violinist in order to catch the violent girl. To find out some tells, to find out some motivation.
Oh, that's a good point. So it may be
and they're kind of done with her now.
Yeah. Okay. That makes me feel better about that. Man, we know so little about these worlds. I can't, because the only thing we get is that one wide establishing shot of what seems to be the same city, but one technologically.
Berlin, I'm thinking, yeah.
You know, one with a bunch of futuristic skyscrapers. And yet what looks so we know that, I don't know, let's call it good world and bad world. Right. Good world where Timid Howard lives and a violin player. Right. It seems like there are more violent people in what I'm provisionally going to call bad world. Right. But it bad world establishing shots show giant technologically advanced towers and yet seem to have a lot more scarcity. It was a big deal that that Bad Howard's wife was able to get a cigarette or whatever. It seems more, and yet the technologically, you know, you see an iPhone in the room of Violin Girl in Good World, and yet everything in that gateway area is all straight up like, you know, 1950s Cold War and a bunch of dot matrix printers and monochrome green screens and stuff. I just want to know so bad, why is that area kind of frozen in time? And, you know, when they talk about war coming, are they talking about war between the worlds, about taking resources and stuff?
Yeah, it seems like it's war between the worlds. And the wife in Prime or Bad World makes a reference to after what they did to us. And it sounds like that world blames our world for whatever happened, and whatever happened has been bad for them. My assumptions up till now have been that at the moment of the split, the prime world, the bad world, stayed communist. East Germany never reunified with West Germany there. And communism still reigns, and that's why there are shortages, but you still have this lovely architecture. That is a hallmark of communist countries, and it just kept you, they're like, this is the way that kept going. And I wonder if there is something else that happened as a result of this split that we didn't notice, but they did. My guess about all of the technology near the gateway being stuck in time is that they don't want to tip their hand to each other about what they're capable of.
Well, I thought about that, and yet they're granting visas to each other. Because I had that exact same thought. But it's like if they're exchanging people, I mean, you can't. They're not fooled when they walk out and there's iPhones in the other world.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, it's a limit of information, not a banning of information.
Got it.
Right?
Okay,
like,
I see.
Okay, we'll give a visa to this person because we trust that they can be exposed to some of what's going on without really, you know, figuring out everything. But we are not going to put our top of the line stuff right there for them to look at every day and really figure it out.
Yeah, I could see that, like, bureaucratically, where it's just like, you know what, let's not make any of this easier for any of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's the crazy part, too, is being a 30-year split means it's a perfect setup because you get two very, very different worlds, but not as different as they're going to be. I mean, 100 years from now, air quotes, 100 years from when this takes place, they will be fundamentally different worlds. There will not be a single human being. There will be no counterparts in 100 years. Like, that's right. The crazy part. There will be no person who has a biologically identical counterpart in the other world. Because, I don't know. I think it's
I think that's one of the little pieces that I really love about this is they're not saying it's parallel worlds. They're like, this was the same world until 30 years ago. It's like, you are the same person until 30 years ago, and then you split into two. And I think that's a concept that hasn't been explored as much as like, oh, we're almost exactly alike. And, you know, it's like, no, you were exactly. You were. There was only one of you up until that point. It's, that's pretty crazy.
Sliding Doors. with featuring J.K. Simmons.
Oh, not since Gwyneth Paltrow's Sliding Doors. And we had such an exploration of alternate reality. So, yeah, I'm digging it, man. I really like it. And I really like that we're not just following Howard's story, but my assumption is next week we're going to get a different counterpart story, possibly. You know, someone else is going to come over, or maybe we'll get more about the wife's story. But I feel like that would be a cool way to go, is to explore different stories about how these two people have diverged each week as an element of the overarching story.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about Deadwood 107. Bullock returns to camp. And boy, are his arms tired.
digging also, all those graves.
Trixie returns to Swearingen's employ. Although I was kind of impressed that they had Trixie play the double agent of like, I'm going to tell both sides the truth. Like, I'm going to tell the widow that Swearingen paid me to tell him everything so that she knows that everything that goes on here is going to go back to Swearingen. I'm going to tell Swearingen, like, yeah, I didn't give her the heroin. I'm sorry, but, you know, I felt that was the better play, and she wasn't going to trust me otherwise. So there you go.
So that was, let's start with that, because this is strangely the coolest head I've ever seen on Swearingen, and the most amount of failure. Essentially, he tells everyone to do everything. Nobody listens to him. And and he just rolls with it like it's no big deal. It is the most un-Swearingen that we see him, but and yet I feel a cold calculation. You know, it doesn't feel like he's being pushed around. It seems to me like he is choosing when and what battles to fight, and none of these, because, you know, Farnham, E.B. Farnham, you know, starts pushing back and still doesn't do it after he's just like, 20 grand, make the offer. He's like, how about 19.5? Because he's a total jerk, right? And then and Trixie doesn't obey, and not, you know, even the new kid, you know, who comes into town with his sister, puts him to work sweeping, and then, you know, makes a comment about, you know, maybe your sister wants to work here. And then the kid was like, you know, you're joking, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, whatever. I'm just a powerless old coot, whatever.
Yeah, and then Veronica Mars goes and gets a job as a whore at Cy Tolliver's place.
Yeah, although I'm hoping you caught it at the end when it's very clear that they're con men and all of this, that they're planning to play the entire town. That was a nice twist. I was like, oh, now, because it's already interesting to see two characters of pure innocence show up in such a shady place. But the idea that this fresh meat that you know, clearly has Swearingen's right-hand man so aroused is, in fact, you know, a very skillful con man duo.
Well, that's what Deadwood should be, right? It's lawless. And lawless means it's going to attract young con people looking for some good scores. It means that Swearingen can't feed everybody to the pigs or he'll run out of people.
Yep.
He's got to choose his battles, like you said. And so there, no one's going to follow rules here. So, of course, people like Farnham are going to push the limits. And, of course, Trixie's just not going to do what she's told. And they have a sense of, like, I think I can get away with this. I don't think Swearingen will want to push it that far. And so it feels more real because of those decisions, those calculated decisions of when to feed the pigs and when not to.
Yeah, Doc continues to become my increasingly favorite character. He's the one pure shining goodness. Oh, and seeing Jane sober and happy and proud of having saved people. Great man, that actress who plays Calamity Jane is just extraordinary, just fantastic.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. In fact, Jane and Doc together are my dream team. It's like, yeah, those are the people I want on my side. I also think it was a nice little roundabout, and I'm not sure what's going to become of it, but I'm sure something is, where Andy gets cured by Jane and Doc after Jane found him in the forest. He's pockmarked as hell, right?
Yep.
But he's alive. And then goes back to get his stuff. And they're like, oh, yeah, we burned our stuff. And Cy Tolliver's like, first tries to be like, oh, we didn't know. And then when Andy's like, look, forget it. Like, drop all that. I just want my stuff. Cy's like, all right, well, let's just forget all of it. Like, what would you have done? Like, there's a certain unvarnished honesty in this episode that comes out, not just with Trixie and not just with Swearingen, but also with Cy, where he's like, yeah, I'm not going to pretend like I didn't F you over, but I had to. What do you expect?
Cy is I like the fact that both Swearingen and Cy have similar machinations and aspirations and two very different takes on how to do it. You know, Swearingen, I don't know. I guess they're very similar in that they put on good guy public faces, but then they do what needs to be done. But I feel like Cy is a lot better at hiding. He's much more discreet with his operation than Swearingen is. And it was neat to see that crack in the facade there.
Also, the little girl, whole big deal with her was whether she could talk or not, right? She woke up, turned out she didn't know English, so everybody kind of relaxed. She's learning English.
Yeah. And about to reveal her name and maybe tell a story.
Yeah. So I kind of feel, I'm looking forward to that popping back up here as well. Well, folks, I hope you're enjoying our tour back through Deadwood and our ongoing counterpart. We are going to get back to Black Mirror next week, right?
Yeah. I've watched all of them. I have thoughts. We'll talk about all three of those, the back half of season four of Black Mirror next week.
All right, so there's something to stay tuned for. Don't forget to be part of the 1850 if you aren't already. You get episodes of Spoiler and Time early if you back us on Patreon at patreon.com/cordkillers. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.